Welcome to our deep dive into the Dead Sea Scrolls.
The Dead Sea Scrolls.
Often hailed as the greatest archaeological discovery related to the Bible. These scrolls have captivated scholars and the public alike for decades.
Yeah.
But before we even get to that famous 1947 discovery, I find it fascinating that this wasn't the first time ancient manuscripts popped up in this area.
Right.
We're talking accounts going as far back as the 2nd century.
It's true for centuries.
Wild.
There have been whispers and rumors of ancient texts hidden away in the Judean desert.
Oh, yeah.
Just waiting to be discovered.
Okay, so let's rewind a bit. Before those Bedouin shepherds stumbled upon those scrolls.
Right.
What were some of these early discoveries? And perhaps more importantly, why did they seem to fade into obscurity?
Well, one intriguing story involves Moses Wilhelm Shapira.
Moses Wilhelm Shapira.
An antiquities dealer who, in the 1880s, claimed to have found ancient Deuteronomy manuscripts.
Deuteronomy manuscripts.
His story caused a sensation, but ultimately ended in accusations of forgery and tragedy.
So even back then, these ancient texts were seen as valuable.
Absolutely.
And worth forging.
The potential historical and religious significance of texts from this region was already recognized.
Yeah.
And in a way, Shapira's story, regardless of its authenticity, set the stage for the skepticism that would initially greet the Dead Sea Scrolls decades later.
It seems like there was a real missed opportunity there. But Shapira wasn't the only one to come across ancient manuscripts in this region, right?
Right around the same time Shapira was making headlines, a scholar named Solomon Schechter, made an incredible discovery in a Cairo synagogue.
Interesting.
The Cairo Geniza.
Cairo Geniza.
Among a treasure trove of ancient Jewish documents, he found a fragment containing teachings of a Jewish sect called the Sons of Zadok.
Sons of Zadok.
I guess what?
Let me guess, something similar popped up among the Dead Sea Scrolls.
You got it. A copy of the same text called the Rule of the Community.
Rule of the Community.
Is found among the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Wow.
So technically, Schechter's discovery could be considered the earliest Dead Sea Scroll find.
Yeah.
Even though it happened far from the Dead Sea itself.
That really highlights the interconnectedness of the ancient world and makes you wonder if these early discoveries had been taken more seriously at the time, would the Dead Sea Scrolls have been met with less skepticism when they finally emerged?
It's a great question and one that's hard to answer definitively.
Yeah.
What we can say for sure is that these early discoveries laid the groundwork for a growing awareness that the Judean desert held secrets of immense historical and religious significance.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in 1947, amidst the political turmoil of Palestine, those Bedouin shepherds made their incredible find.
So set the scene for us. It's 1947, Palestine is on edge, and these shepherds are out looking for a lost sheep.
Right.
What happened next?
The story goes that one of the shepherds tossed a rock into a cave.
Into a cave.
Hoping to spare out the sheep.
Okay.
Instead, he heard the shattering of pottery.
Pottery.
Curiosity got the better of them, and when they investigated, they found clay jars containing these ancient scrolls.
Wow.
Imagine their surprise.
They must have been shocked. I mean, they probably weren't expecting to stumble upon ancient history.
Right.
While searching for a stray sheep.
Initially, they hoped for treasure, gold, or silver.
Oh, yeah.
But what they found were these brittle, moldy scrolls.
Brittle, moldy scrolls.
They weren't sure what to make of them.
Yeah.
And it wasn't immediately clear to anyone else either. The scrolls bounced around a bit.
Oh, wow.
Passing through the hands of various shopkeepers before landing with Mar Athanasius Yeshu Samuel.
Mar Athanasius Yeshu Samuel.
The Metropolitan of the Syrian Orthodox Church.
And even then, with an authority figure like the Metropolitan involved.
Right.
There was still doubt about their authenticity.
You'd think that would lend them some credibility, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But the scholarly world was initially skeptical, remember Shapira?
Yeah.
The fear of forgery was still fresh in people's minds.
Makes sense.
Plus, the idea that scrolls this old could have survived in those harsh desert conditions seemed improbable to many.
But amidst all this doubt and uncertainty, there were a few individuals who recognized the scrolls' potential.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about them.
Well, there was George Isaiah.
George Isaiah.
The shopkeeper who first understood they might be more than just old scraps of writing.
Right.
And we can't forget Khalil Iskander Shaheen.
Khalil Iskander Shaheen.
Known as Kondo.
Kondo.
Who acted as a middleman.
Okay.
both played crucial roles in ensuring the scrolls didn't simply disappear back into obscurity.
And of course, on the scholarly side, there's Eliezer Sukenik.
Eliezer Sukenik.
He was one of the few who saw the scrolls' true value right away.
Sukenik was a pioneering Israeli archaeologist, and he was absolutely determined to acquire some of these scrolls for study.
Yeah.
Think about this in 1947.
1947.
With tensions rising between Arabs and Jews in Palestine, he risked his life.
Wow.
To travel to Bethlehem, which was in Arab-controlled territory at the time, just to get a closer look at these scrolls.
What dedication. But it wasn't just academic curiosity that drove him, was it?
Right.
There's a sense of urgency, too.
Absolutely. The political situation was incredibly volatile.
Yeah.
Remember the 1948 Arab-Israeli war was just around the corner?
Oh, yeah.
Sukenik knew that if these scrolls fell into the wrong hands, they might be lost to scholarship forever.
And in a way, his fears were justified, weren't they?
Right.
The scrolls were ultimately divided
between
Israeli and Jordanian institutions. So tell us, what did Sukenik manage to acquire?
He purchased three scrolls, and not just any scrolls.
Okay.
He managed to secure the Isaiah scroll.
Isaiah's
a nearly complete copy of the book of Isaiah.
Wow.
Hundreds of years older than any other known copy at the time.
That's incredible.
Plus, he acquired the War Scroll.
War Scroll.
Which describes a future apocalyptic battle, and the Thanksgiving Hymns Scroll.
Thanksgiving Hymns Scroll.
A collection of poetic prayers.
And what about those other scrolls, the ones that the Metropolitan was trying to sell? What happened to them?
Well, remember those American school students we mentioned earlier?
Yeah.
William Brownlee and John Trevor.
William Brownlee.
John Trevor.
Yeah.
They happened to be at the American school in Jerusalem.
Okay.
When the Metropolitan brought the scrolls there, hoping to find a buyer.
Right.
With most people evacuated due to the escalating violence.
Yeah.
They were some of the only scholars available to examine them.
So here we have these two young scholars thrust into the center of what would become one of the greatest archaeological discoveries of the 20th century. I bet that was a bit overwhelming.
I can only imagine, but they rose to the occasion.
Good for them.
They recognized the scroll's potential and immediately contacted William Albright.
William Albright.
A renowned biblical scholar.
Yeah.
He was blown away, Albright, upon seeing photos of the scrolls.
Photo?
Called it the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times. Talk about a validation.
Those students must have been thrilled. So we have these scrolls now recognized as incredibly valuable.
Right.
But I recall you mentioned something about them deteriorating.
Yes. That's John Trevor's contribution to this story.
Oh, okay.
Those scrolls were already incredibly fragile after lying in those caves for centuries.
Yeah.
The ink was fading and the parchment was brittle.
Oh, wow.
So Trevor, amidst the chaos of war-torn Jerusalem.
Oh, my gosh.
Scoured the city for photographic supplies.
Wow.
He even used outdated film just to capture as much of the scrolls as possible before they deteriorated further.
That's remarkable. He was essentially racing against time.
Yeah.
Understanding that every moment was critical in preserving these ancient texts.
His efforts were truly heroic. His photos are now priceless.
Yeah.
The original scrolls have darkened and become even more fragile over time.
Wow.
Making those photographs vital for studying the scrolls.
It's amazing that he had the forethought to do that.
Yeah. But back then, those photos played another role, too.
Okay.
They helped to convince the wider scholarly world that these scrolls were, in fact, genuine and of immense historical value.
Okay. So we have Sukenik with his three scrolls.
Right.
And photos of the Metropolitan scrolls circulating among scholars.
Right.
But what about the Metropolitan himself? Was he still trying to sell his scrolls?
He was, but with limited options in war-torn Jerusalem, he took a rather unconventional route.
What did he do?
He placed an ad in the Wall Street Journal.
Wait, the Wall Street Journal? Seriously, that seems almost comical.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Imagine one of the most significant archaeological discoveries of all time.
Yeah.
Advertised in a newspaper alongside job postings and used car sales.
Ideal gift for an educational or religious institution.
You can't make this stuff up.
So did anyone bite?
Luckily, yes.
Oh, good.
Yigal Yadin. Sukenik's son was the one who spotted the ad.
Okay.
He, along with scholar Harry Orlinsky, who went by the alias Mr. Green to keep the negotiations secret.
Oh, wow.
Flew to New York and managed to secure the remaining scrolls for Israel.
So ultimately, all seven of these initially discovered scrolls ended up in Israel.
Yes.
But it sounds like that's just the beginning of the story, right?
Right.
This discovery set off a chain reaction, a race to find more scrolls.
Exactly, with the scrolls' importance now undeniable.
Yeah.
Both the Israelis and the Jordanians, who each controlled parts of the region where the scrolls were found, recognized the potential treasures hidden in those Judean desert caves.
Oh, yeah.
It became a race against time and each other to locate and secure any remaining scrolls.
So who are the key players in this race, and where did it lead them?
On the Israeli side, you have Yigal Yadin Sukinik's son.
Okay.
Taking up the mantle, leading expeditions into the caves in the territory they controlled.
Mm.
What's interesting is that they found evidence of Bedouin activity in some of the most remote and inaccessible caves.
Wow.
Showing how determined these local tribes were to find and potentially profit from the scrolls.
It makes you wonder how many scrolls were actually found and sold.
Right.
Before anyone truly understood their value.
Absolutely. And on the Jordanian side, you have Captain Ash El-Zeben.
Captain Ash El-Zeben.
A member of the Jordanian Arab Legion.
Okay.
He was the one who rediscovered the very cave where the first scrolls were found. Cave 1.
Cave 1.
As it's now known.
Okay.
His rediscovery led to the Jordanian Department of Antiquities.
Oh.
Joining forces with Roland DeVoe.
Roland DeVoe.
A French scholar.
Okay.
To excavate the nearby site of Kerbet Qumran.
Kerbet Qumran, that name keeps popping up.
Yeah.
What exactly was this place, and why is it so significant to the Dead Sea Scrolls story?
Imagine this, a settlement perched on a plateau overlooking the Dead Sea.
Okay.
Strategically located and with a surprisingly sophisticated water system of dams and cisterns.
Dams and cisterns.
This was Kerbet Qumran.
Kerbet Qumran.
And excavations here revealed a story that stretched back centuries.
Centuries. So it wasn't just some temporary encampment.
Not at all the earliest traces of occupation at Kerbet Qumran.
Oh.
Go back to the 9th or 8th century BC.
9th or 8th century.
It's possible that the site was even connected to the biblical King Uzziah.
King Uzziah.
But around 125 BC, a new group arrived, a Jewish sect, who built the structures that we see today.
Okay.
They constructed ritual baths known as mikvot.
Mikvot?
Hinting at a strong emphasis on ritual purity.
Okay.
And it was during this period that many of the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually written.
So they were living there, creating and copying these texts.
Yes.
Right around the time that many of the events described in the scrolls were unfolding.
Exactly. It's like we're peering into a time capsule.
Yeah.
Connecting the physical remains of their daily lives with the ideas and beliefs expressed in their writings.
That must be fascinating to see that connection.
But their time at Qumran wasn't without turmoil.
Okay.
In 31 BC, a massive earthquake rocked the region, causing significant damage to the settlement.
Talk about a shakeup, literally.
Indeed. And despite rebuilding, their time at Qumran was drawing to a close in 68 AD.
68 AD.
The Romans arrived, forcing the inhabitants to abandon the site.
Oh, no.
It's believed that they hid their precious scrolls in nearby caves for safekeeping.
What a cliffhanger. So who were these people who lived at Qumran?
Yes.
What were their beliefs?
Right.
And why did they devote themselves to creating and preserving these scrolls?
That's what we'll delve into next time.
Okay.
As we uncover the secrets hidden within the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves, stay tuned.
Can't wait. Welcome back to our deep dive into the Dead Sea Scrolls. Last time we set the stage with those early discoveries and the dramatic circumstances surrounding the 1947 find.
Yeah.
Now it's time to actually unlock the secrets held within the scrolls themselves.
Right.
What can these ancient texts tell us about the community at Qumran, their beliefs, and their practices?
Imagine piecing together a giant ancient jigsaw puzzle.
Ooh.
That's what scholars have been grappling with for decades.
Yeah.
We're talking about hundreds of manuscripts.
Wow.
Some complete, but many in fragments, written in Hebrew, Aramaic, and even Greek.
That sounds daunting.
Yeah.
Where do you even begin with something like that?
Well, it's been a massive collaborative effort. Scholars from various disciplines have been painstakingly translating, analyzing, and interpreting these texts for decades.
Yeah.
And what they found has revolutionized our understanding of Second Temple Judaism.
Let's dive into some of the specifics then. What kinds of texts are we actually talking about here?
First, there are the biblical texts. Nearly every book of the Hebrew Bible is represented among the scrolls.
Oh, wow.
That's hugely significant because it provides us with some of the oldest known copies of these texts, predating previously known manuscripts by centuries.
So we're actually getting a glimpse into the Bible as it existed before the time of Jesus.
It really is, and it allows us to compare these older versions to later versions.
Okay.
Like the Masoretic text.
Masoretic text.
Which is what most modern Bibles are based on. And okay. Guess what? There are some interesting variations.
Variations like what? Missing verses, secret chapters, Give me the juicy details.
Well, some are pretty minor, just differences in wording, but others involve entire sections or verses that are added or omitted.
Wow.
It really sheds light on the evolution of the biblical text, showing how these stories were transmitted and interpreted over time.
So even something as seemingly fixed and unchanging as the Bible actually has a history, a story of its own, with different versions and interpretations existing side by side.
Exactly. And that's just the biblical text. Many of the scrolls are non-biblical, what scholars often refer to as sectarian writings.
Okay.
These offer a fascinating window into the beliefs and practices of the community that lived at Qumran.
Okay. Sectarian writings, help me out here. That term can sound a little, well, negative, almost like a cult. What's the deal with this community? Were they really that different from mainstream Judaism?
Well, the term sectarian simply means they had their own distinct interpretations and practices within Judaism.
What?
Remember, this was a time of great social and religious upheaval in Judea.
Yeah.
Many Jews felt that the temple in Jerusalem had become corrupt, and they were searching for a way to live a more authentic, pure form of Judaism.
So they were kind of like a back-to-basics movement within Judaism.
In a way, yes. They emphasized a very strict adherence to the law of Moses.
Mm.
But they also had their own unique interpretations.
Yep.
For example, they believed in communal living.
Communal living.
A strict hierarchy within the community.
Wow.
And they had these incredibly detailed rules and regulations governing everything from prayer to hygiene.
Wow, that sounds intense. And didn't you mention something about them having apocalyptic expectations?
Yes. The scrolls are filled with this vivid imagery of a coming cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil.
Oh, wow.
They believed that God would ultimately intervene, ushering in a new age of righteousness. This apocalyptic worldview really permeates their writings.
It's interesting, you know, because some of these themes sound very familiar, almost like a preview of ideas that would later appear in early Christianity.
That's one of the reasons why the Dead Sea Scrolls are so significant. They provide us with a glimpse into the religious and social world in which Jesus and early Christianity emerged.
Yeah.
While there's no direct mention of Jesus or early Christians in the scrolls, the overlaps in language imagery and even some of the theological concepts are really striking.
It makes you wonder, was there any direct connection? Could Jesus or the early Christians have been influenced by this Qumran community?
It's a possibility that scholars are still exploring. Some see the Essenes, a Jewish sect mentioned by ancient historians like Josephus and Pliny the Elder, as the most likely candidates for the community at Qumran. And there are definitely some tantalizing parallels between Essene beliefs and the ideas expressed in the scrolls.
Wait, didn't you say the scrolls themselves never actually mention the Essenes? It's all a bit circumstantial, isn't it?
You're right. It's one of the ongoing mysteries surrounding the scrolls. We have all these pieces of the puzzle, but the full picture remains elusive.
Really?
And that's part of what makes studying the Dead Sea Scrolls so fascinating. It's an active field of research with ongoing debates and new discoveries constantly adding to the conversation.
Okay, let's get back to these sectarian writings themselves. Are there any specific texts that stand out, ones that really encapsulate this community's worldview?
Absolutely. One of the most important is the Community Rule, also known as the Manual of Discipline.
The Unity Rule.
Manual of Discipline.
Yeah.
This text lays out in incredible detail the rules and regulations governing life within the community.
Right.
Think of it as a rule book for a very, very serious monastery.
Okay. Monastery rule book. Give me some examples.
Well, it outlines their admission procedures, their communal meals, their study practices, their system of punishments for transgressions.
Oh, wow.
They were incredibly structured and disciplined with a strong emphasis on communal harmony and spiritual purity.
So definitely not your casual drop-in synagogue crowd.
Right.
These guys were serious.
They were. And another significant text is the War Scroll. This one describes a future war between the Sons of Light.
Sons of Light.
Representing the Qumran community and their allies.
Okay.
And the Sons of Darkness.
Sons of Darkness.
Representing all those opposed to God. It's an epic apocalyptic battle filled with vivid imagery and symbolism.
Whoa. Talk about dramatic. But were they actually preparing for a real war? Or was this all symbolic?
That's a great question, and it's one that scholars debate. Some interpretations suggest the community was actively preparing for armed conflict.
Okay.
Others see it more symbolically as a representation of the spiritual struggle between good and evil that they believed was playing out in the world.
It makes sense living in a time and place marked by constant political and religious turmoil. It's easy to see how those anxieties might manifest in their writings.
Exactly. And there's another text that sheds light on their apocalyptic worldview, the Pesher Habakkuk.
Pesher Habakkuk.
This is a commentary that interprets the words of the prophet Habakkuk in light of their own contemporary events.
So they're essentially taking an existing biblical text and saying, see, this prophecy is all about us. This is happening right now.
That's a great way to put it. They saw themselves as the righteous remnant chosen by God to play a key role in the coming end times. They even identified a figure called the Teacher of Righteousness.
Teacher of Righteousness.
Who they believed was a persecuted leader foreshadowing the coming Messiah.
It's amazing how they're able to weave together biblical prophecy, their own historical context, and their hopes for the future, all within these scrolls.
It's a testament to their creativity, their devotion, and their deep engagement with their faith.
Okay, so we've got these fascinating texts, but what's been even more difficult to unravel is who exactly were the authors? We've hinted at the Essenes, but there's no definitive proof.
It's true, and the debate over the scroll's authorship and the nature of the community at Qumran continues to this day. So next time, we'll delve into some of the leading theories and examine the ongoing controversies that surround these extraordinary texts.
We've spent the last two parts of our deep dive exploring the Dead Sea Scrolls, from those early, almost forgotten discoveries to the incredible texts themselves. We've seen how these scrolls have revolutionized our understanding of Second Temple Judaism and even hinted at potential connections to early Christianity. But there's still one big question lingering. Who were these people who created and preserved these scrolls?
It's a question that has fueled countless debates and kept scholars busy for decades. The scrolls themselves don't give us a clear-cut answer. We have all this incredible detail about their beliefs, practices, and their expectations for the future, but their precise identity remains shrouded in mystery.
So it's like having this incredible archive, this detailed diary almost, but with the author's name redacted.
Exactly. And this is where those tantalizing connections to the Essenes come into play. Remember, those were a Jewish sect described by ancient historians like Josephus and Pliny the Elder. They seem to emphasize ritual purity, communal living, and a belief in a coming Messiah.
All themes that we've encountered in the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. But is that enough to say definitively that the Essenes were the authors?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Many scholars believe the evidence is strong. Pliny the Elder, for instance, specifically mentions a community of Essenes living on the western shore of the Dead Sea, not far from where the scrolls were found.
Okay. I can see why that would be persuasive, living in the same area, sharing similar beliefs. It adds up. But what about the scholars who aren't convinced? What are their arguments?
Not all scholars are ready to jump on the Essene bandwagon. Some argue that the evidence is too circumstantial. They point out that the scrolls never actually mention the Essenes by name. Plus, there are some discrepancies between what we know about the Essenes from historical accounts and the details presented in the scrolls.
So it's not a perfect match. Are there any alternative theories out there? If it wasn't the Essenes, who else could it have been?
Well, some scholars suggest that the community at Qumran might have been a branch of the Pharisees, another Jewish sect known for their strict adherence to Jewish law. Others propose they might have even been a faction of the Sadducees, which is interesting because the Sadducees were known for their more conservative views and their emphasis on temple rituals.
The Sadducees, that's surprising. It seems like their beliefs wouldn't really align with the apocalyptic expectations we see in the scrolls.
You would think so, wouldn't you? But remember, the scrolls present a complex picture. It's possible that the community at Qumran drew from various strands of Jewish thought and practice. Perhaps they weren't a monolithic group, but rather a collection of individuals with diverse backgrounds and beliefs, united by their desire to live a more pure and devout form of Judaism.
So rather than trying to fit them into a neat little box, we should consider that they might have been a more dynamic and diverse group than we initially imagined. It seems like every time we think we have them figured out, another layer of complexity emerges.
Exactly, and there are even more theories out there. Some scholars believe that the community at Qumran might have been made up of disenchanted priests, perhaps those who had been expelled from the Jerusalem temple for their views. This would explain their deep knowledge of scripture and their desire to preserve these texts.
So they were taking their traditions and knowledge with them into the wilderness, creating their own library in exile, away from what they perceived as the corruption of Jerusalem.
It's a compelling image, isn't it? And there's another theory that, while held by a minority of scholars, is worth considering. Some believe that Qumran wasn't a sectarian settlement at all, but rather a kind of national library for the Jewish people, a place where important texts were collected and preserved.
A national library. That's a bold idea.
Yeah.
What's the reasoning behind that theory?
Well, they point to the sheer diversity of scrolls found at Qumran, including multiple copies of the same biblical book, sometimes with significant variations. Why would a small, isolated community need so many copies of the same texts? It suggests that perhaps they were acting as custodians for a much larger collection of Jewish writings.
It makes you wonder if that's the case. What other treasures might have been housed there? And what happened to those texts when the community abandoned Qumran? So many questions.
And that's what keeps the Dead Sea Scrolls so captivating. Every new discovery, every new interpretation adds another layer to this intricate puzzle.
Well, it certainly feels like we've only scratched the surface in our deep dive today. And in a way, it's reassuring to know that the journey of discovery isn't over.
Not at all. The Dead Sea Scrolls continue to challenge our assumptions about Second Temple Judaism, about the origins of Christianity, and about the very nature of faith and religious practice in the ancient world.
So where do we go from here? What are some of the big questions that still need answers?
For one, there's still a lot of work to be done on the non-biblical texts. Many of them remain partially untranslated, or their meaning is still debated. Unlocking those secrets could shed even more light on the community at Qumran and their worldview.
It's like we've only just begun to decipher the code, to really understand the nuances of their beliefs and practices.
Exactly. And then there's the ongoing debate about the scroll's authorship. Will new evidence emerge that definitively proves or disproves the Essene theory? Or will we need to embrace a more nuanced understanding of their origins, accepting that perhaps there's no single answer?
It makes you wonder, are we as humans even comfortable with ambiguity? Can we accept that some historical mysteries might never be fully solved?
That's the beauty of history, isn't it? It's not just about finding the right answers. It's about the process of exploration, of piecing together fragmented evidence, and of grappling with the unknown. And in the case of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that journey is far from over.
Well said. On that note, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive into the Dead Sea Scrolls. Uh-huh. We've covered a lot of ground, but this is really just the beginning of your own exploration. So keep digging, keep questioning, and who knows what other treasures you might uncover in this fascinating world of ancient history.